welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, showcasing programs from radio's golden age. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, stories of true history. Later on, it's Mr. President, as well as an excerpt of the program behind the mic for some true radio history. But right now, it's Adventures in Research. From Westinghouse Syndication, their 214th program from the 40s, with the story of DDT called The Lost Chemical.
Adventures in Research. This is the story of the lost chemical and how it was found. The story of a compound known to science as dichloro, diphenyl, trichloroethane. Dichloro, diphenyl, trichloroethane. Known to people like you and me as DDT, the bug killer. We are apt to think of DDT as a very recent discovery, for only in the last few years have we heard about this potent compound. But strangely enough, DDT is far from new, for dichlorodiphenyltrichloroethane was a chemical lost beneath the gathering dust of time for many years. Who discovered it? How did it get lost? Who found it again? What characters from the strange book of research history played a part in this dramatic game of button-button, who's got the button? That is the story. First, there was Othmar Seidler of Strasbourg, Germany, a strange young student of chemistry whose preference for his work far exceeded his desire for play, a trait responsible in part for the discovery of the bug battler we know today.
Hello! Anybody home in this apothecary shop?
Yes, what's that? Who is there?
Morning, Uncle Carl.
Huh? Oh, it's you, Otmar. Why must you shout like that? Frighten me, so I very nearly dropped my best mixing mortar.
No, I'm sorry, Uncle Carl. I guess I'm just a little over-elated this morning.
Over-elated. You must have met a young lady at the dance last night.
You're wrong on both counts, Uncle Carl. I didn't go to the dance.
Didn't go to the big dance?
Neither did I meet a new young lady.
Too bad. Then what else is making you so frisky?
I did make the acquaintance of a new chemical.
Yes, of course. What? I must be getting a little deaf, maybe. Say that again, son.
I said I met a new chemical.
Yes? Well, I guess I'm not getting deaf. It's you. You must be losing your reason.
Nothing of the kind, Uncle Carl. Last night, as I was working in my laboratory on some very routine experiments, I ran across a mixture that is completely different. Believe me, completely different from anything I've ever had before in my test tube.
You're sure about this?
Of course. I have the formula for the new chemical right here in my pocket.
Ah, that's good.
There it is. Don't you want to see it?
Well, if I have to, I suppose I have to. Here, let me have it.
Here. Can you read it?
My boy, I've been reading formulae for a longer time than you've been eating, even.
Of course, Uncle Carl. I only
meant... All right, now, let's see. 5 parts of... Trichloroethane. What is this? It's a completely new chemical.
There you are. Didn't I tell you it was?
Yes, it's new, all right, but... Well, what's it good for?
I haven't the slightest idea. It's probably useless. But at any rate, I think I should write it up and have it published in the Chemical Society reports, don't you?
Don't I what?
Think so.
Oh, yes, by all means. By all means, have it published. It's at least good for that.
And so it was that DDT was first discovered in the modest laboratory of Othmar Seidler, the strange young chemical student who wrote up his discovery, published it, and faded into oblivion in 1874, 2 years before the centennial of American independence. And into oblivion with Herr Seidler passed his mysterious new chemical, good at least for publication, to be lost among the shelves of nearly every good scientific library in the world. And while it languished there among the dusty tomes, the world was eroded by the tragedy, the misery, the failure of finance and government, methodically plagued and beridden by bugs. Creatures of our little world, armies of them, that the lost chemical might well have put to rout. The years roll by now, and men ineffectually battle the miniature monsters, while dichloro, diphenyl, trichloroethane is only waiting for the man who, searching with a purpose, can release it, like Sleeping Beauty, from its long, long nap. Finally, in the late 30s, the Prince Charming who will accomplish the awakening steps into the picture. The stage is a Swiss chemical factory where dyes and dressings for expensive as well as inexpensive clothing materials are produced. Being a modern establishment and progressive, this Swiss firm maintains a well-equipped research laboratory. One of the chemists, Paul Mueller, has stopped his employer, Mr. Ludwig, to call his attention to a vial of liquid that, in appearance, is very little different from the many other vials of liquid nearly overflowing the racks and shelves in the laboratory.
What did you have here, Paul?
Mr. Ludwig, this is a little mixture I've been playing with. I found the formula for it in one of these old journals right here.
Let's see. Reports of the German Chemical Society, 1850 to 1900. Old, isn't it?
Yes, I just came upon it by chance. But I think it may help us in our moth-proofing problem.
Let's see.
These ingredients ought to have some effect. In fact, I can't for the life of me imagine why someone hasn't thought of it before.
Maybe they have. And then again, maybe they haven't. Go ahead, try it. It might work. But I'd be inclined to doubt it. Or we have heard of it before. Yes, I'm sure we would. However, as I say, try it. If it fails, there's little loss. Little loss.
Paul Mueller did try it. He mixed the chemicals that the old formula called for, spent many an hour trying a little more of one ingredient, a little less of another, striking the proper chemical balance suitable to the use he had in mind. And then he trapped a few moths and a few flies, exposed them to the long-forgotten Othmar Zeidler's chemical.
Well, this is a find indeed. A real find.
Of his results, Paul Mueller said not a word to his employer. For the experiments had only just begun, and Paul Mueller wasn't the one to crow about his work before he had proved it could bring results. But while he worked in his laboratory there at the factory, events were shaping that were to bring the lost chemical out of the library and the laboratory to spread its active, powerful magic across many nations, to girdle the world in the path of World War II.
It's a very grave problem, Mr. Ludwig.
I understand your problem quite well, Mr. Pemmel. Insects are ruining your grape arbors.
Not mine alone, Mr. Ludwig, but all the arbors, all the wonderful, beautiful, profitable vineyards in Switzerland are being ruined. And why? Because of the war, that's why. One world war was not enough. Two we have to have yet. You must help us, Mr. Ludwig. You must.
But we are helpless, Mr. Bemmel. Trust me, I speak the truth.
But without insecticides, without any chemical at all, we are lost. The war has cut off all our supplies. The pyrethrum, very fine, is no longer available. The rotenone, excellent, is also unprocurable.
I wish I could help you. The future of our vineyards and our wineries is as important to me as it is to you. For isn't it a part of the Swiss economy?
Yes.
But please understand, though we are chemists, it is dye stuffs in which we specialize, don't you see?
See, of course I see. But you are chemists. Mr. Ludwig, you have your research men working in your laboratories. Couldn't they find something besides colors for fabric?
Mr. Bemmel, you are... excuse me a minute, Mr. Bemmel.
Of course.
Miss Kohler, please have Paul Mueller come in. Mr. Bemmel, I shall let you speak personally to our research man, Mr. Mueller, to convince you that we would help if only we could. I'm sure that if there is anything... come in, Paul. Mr. Mueller... This is Mr.
Bemmel. A pleasure, Mr. Mueller.
Of course, Mr. Bemmel. He is the owner of a large vineyard, Paul. He is faced, he tells me, with the problem of losing his fruit to the ravages of some sort of insect.
Oh, it is terrible, Mr. Mueller, terrible. We shall be ruined by them. And there is no insecticide available because of the war. That is why I am here, to ask the kind assistance of your company.
I try to assure Mr. Bemmel there is nothing they can do to get him a chemical to take the place of the ones they've been using here before.
But perhaps we can give him one, sir.
You can?
What's
this? See, Paul, this is no time.
I haven't spoken to you about it before because I wasn't completely done with my experiment. But you recall the old formula, the one I showed you in the scientific journal.
Oh, I can't say that. Yes, I do. But that was for Mort. Mr. Bemmel wants...
Well, there's no reason why it need be confined to a material for moth proofing, sir. If you could see its action, you'd agree it might be suitable for disposing of many insects, aside from moth. I've tested it on numerous pests, and in every case, the action is about the same. Craziness first, a mad dizziness, a wild attempted flight, and then... poof.
Dead?
Dead.
We must try it. We must. Perhaps it is the heaven-sent chemical we need.
What did you say the name of it was called, Mr. Mueller?
Dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane.
What?
DDT.
Out of Paul Mueller's laboratory in the Swiss Dye Works came DDT, into the light of day at last. Ammunition to quell the ravishing onslaught of the insects that were fast gnawing at the profits of the Swiss vintners. Soon the company turned to earnest production of the newfound chemical miracle. And farmers saw their fruit and their vegetables blossom and flourish as never before, while the population of pests grew gradually less and less. And the bugs had only just begun to die. For as reports from the far-flung battlefronts of World War II filtered in, the company producing DDT observed a very important military need for their chemical.
How can our soldiers fight the enemy in the tropics, infested as they are with malaria? We must be rid of it.
Oh, if we can lick the Anopheles mosquito in the tropics, we'll have a chance. And that isn't all. Typhus, too. That flea-borne plague is worse than any airborne infantry.
You see the news, gentlemen. You know how important a good insecticide is. As we know, we have it. Might be a very good idea to contact our American office, in our code, of course, and have them pass the word along to the American government that we have a very important weapon for sale. Is the board not agreed?
The board agreed, indeed. And soon the news of DDT was transmitted to the American government through the American representative of the Swiss dye makers. Faced with the immediate need for an offensive against the disease-bearing bugs of the tropics and the trenches, the United States military authorities grasped willingly at the proffered formula. Then began a whirlwind of activity. In research laboratories that buzzed 24 hours a day, DDT was put through its chemical paces. Then samples carried by researchers in the field were taken to a variety of climates. DDT was tested on the spot for its talents and came through with colors flying. Proved itself in action. From therein, it's a well-known story. The lost chemical, brought to light after more than half a century, was used by the Allied armies all over the world. And now, today, in peacetime, DDT is still hard at work in our post-war battles against those troublemakers that crawl and fly and fight, that carry the germs of disease to men, to plants, to animals. If Othmar Zeidler, the young man who first compounded his unknown chemical, could see it working now, he'd surely be shocked with amazement to see the multitude of uses modern science has found for what to him was a useless new chemical. An heroic end, indeed, for such an unpretentious beginning to one of the world's most peculiar adventures in research. And that's today's story by Dr. Phillips Thomas, research engineer of the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. This is Paul Shannon inviting you to join us again next week for another transcribed Adventures in Research.
Adventures in Research, on Tuned to Yesterday from Westinghouse Syndication, their 214th program from the early 1940s. You're listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. And now time for Mr. President. From July 31st, 1947, on ABC, Edward Arnold portraying one of the presidents before that time, and based on historical facts, the president he is playing won't be revealed until the end of the broadcast. With Betty Lou Gerson as Secretary Sarah, it's Mr. President.
Transcribed in Hollywood and starring Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's Edward Arnold. Mr. President, at home in the White House, the elected leader of our people, our fellow citizen and neighbor. These are little-known stories of the men who've lived in the White House. Dramatic, exciting events in their lives that you and I so rarely hear. True human stories of Mr. President.
In just a moment, you will hear Edward Arnold as Mr. President. But first, may we point out the truth of the saying, history repeats itself. For instance, did you know that there has been a president of the United States who was a general in our army and who was drafted for the presidency? Did you know that there was a president who broke with both regular parties and formed a third party of his own? Did you know that there was a president who promoted a general over the heads of a dozen other officers because the president believed that general was a better commander than his superiors? Yes, these incidents sound familiar to you in the light of our own times, and yet they all happened many years ago. Here on this weekly radio program, you listen to those stories and learn of the great men who have made our history. Listen now to this story and see if you can name the president whose career this story is about. Now, in just a moment, Edward Arnold.
Edward Arnold as Mr. President. Let's visit him in the White House. It is Sunday, and the old mansion is resting quietly after a busy week. We walk through the great doors under the presidential seal, across the foyer and down the long hall to the president's study.
Oh, hello. Sit down, won't you? You know, in a lot of ways, a president can be compared to the father of a family. It's true, especially when a president's been in office for several years. He comes to think of his cabinet and all the men who hold offices under him as members of one large family. No matter how much wrangling and arguing there might be at times within that family, whenever the reputation of one of its members is threatened, the president takes it as a personal problem. That's what happens in our story today. Later on, of course, I'll tell you what president had to face such a problem. But meanwhile, you may be able to guess. It was about 5 months before the end of my final term in office. An early spring day with warm sunshine flooding the White House lawn. I turned for a moment to glance out of my office window at the fresh green of the trees when my secretary entered.
Mr. President?
Hmm? Well, oh, yes, Miss Sarah.
Oh, I'm sorry if I disturbed you.
No, no, you didn't at all.
You seem many miles away, sir.
Well, many years away is more like it. I was thinking that if I was still a gangling Virginia boy, wild horses couldn't keep me from going fishing on a day like this. Miss Sarah, you'd better give me a dose of my mother's favorite remedy for spring fever. Molasses and turpentine.
Mr. President, what you need is a long rest. If you could just get away from Washington for a while and all the problems you have here.
Miss Sarah, there's one thing I've learned about problems. If you try to leave them before they're solved, they follow you like your own shadow. Have the cabinet members arrived for this morning's meeting?
Yes, sir, but there's something I think you should know about before you meet with the cabinet.
Really? What is it? You're worried.
Well, I hate to be the one to tell you, sir. I know how upset you are over that A.B. plot against Secretary Crawford.
Oh, no, don't tell me. The paper has printed another one of those letters attacking Crawford.
Yes, sir.
What charges does the anonymous attacker make this time?
I have the paper here, sir. Uh-huh. In general, the accusations are the same, that the Secretary of the Treasury is incompetent, that he's mishandled the government's funds.
No, it's a lot of unfounded poppycock. I certainly wouldn't have kept Crawford in my cabinet for almost 8 years if he weren't competent.
And then the letter goes on to discredit his qualifications for the presidency.
Oh, of course, of course. The whole aim of these letters that have been plaguing us for a year is to ruin Crawford's chances in the fall election.
Well, this last paragraph is particularly strong, Mr. President. I'd like you to read it, sir.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me see it. It's
right there, sir.
And I have it on good authority that the president is greatly opposed to vacating his executive chair to William Harris Crawford. Good authority. Backroom Washington gossip.
The letters have caused a great deal of talk, sir.
Don't I know it? They've become the great Washington mystery. A few addled brains have even gone so far as to suspect that I'm the author of them.
Oh, but that's ridiculous.
Oh, I realize Crawford has bitter personal feelings toward me because I beat him in the election 8 years ago. He's even been able to... Well, he's been able to forgive me for that. But he hasn't let personal interest interfere with his work as a cabinet member before, and I don't expect him now. Please show the gentleman in. Then I can count on you to take care of that bill for me, Adler.
Yes, Mr. President.
Now, there's just one more matter which I'm sure you will all agree on, and then you can all go to lunch. I'm appointing Ninian Edwards minister to Mexico.
Good selection, in my opinion, sir.
Well, then we might as well...
I'm sorry, Mr. President, but I shall have to disagree with the Secretary of State and the other gentlemen.
What's that, Crawford?
I think it would be a serious mistake to send Ninian Edwards to Mexico.
Why?
I assume you have reasons for making such a statement, Crawford?
Certainly, sir. I ask you to examine his history as governor of Illinois.
Oh, I did that quite thoroughly. I consider his record excellent.
He placed personal interests before the interests of the state. He used his governorship to foster his own financial gains.
Oh, come now, Crawford.
Look at the facts, sir. He built factories throughout Illinois during his governorship.
But he was established in that business before his election.
Mr. President, I'm very serious about this. Ninian Edwards is not the type person for a diplomatic post.
I'm sorry, but I can't understand this prejudice of yours, Crawford, against Edwards. Unless you have some reasons you're not stating.
I rather think, sir, you don't care to see my point of view. Perhaps there's some truth in the letter printed in this morning's...
Crawford, I don't feel a cabinet member should discuss the A.B. letters.
I didn't intend to, sir, and yet when they're the topic of conversation in every Washington gathering, when I can feel myself being stared at and whispered about as I walk down the street, why should the subject be so studiously avoided in cabinet meetings? I've had to bear the false attacks of those vicious letters for over a year.
I assure you, Crawford, those letters have been a constant source of worry to me also.
Hardly as much as to me, I imagine, sir. After all, your term in office is nearly over. Your future is not at stake.
But the record of my administration will be a matter of history. And I am most anxious that its tone be honorable.
If that's true, sir, it seems to me you could have been more successful in uncovering the author of these letters.
A president is still just an ordinary man, you know. Not a crystal gazer. I've done all in my power to discover the identity of the person signing himself A.B. I can do no more.
But I can hardly see, sir.
And I don't care to discuss it further. Do you have any other points against my appointment of Ninian Edwards to Mexico, Crawford?
No, sir. But I will again say that I think you're making a very bad choice.
You have a right to your opinion. But as you know, the final decision is still mine. Come in, Miss Zara.
Mr. President, Mr. Clinton is here.
Oh, fine. Show him right in, won't you?
The President will see you now, Mr. Clinton.
Thank you, Miss Zara. Good afternoon, Mr. President.
Oh, hello, Henry. I'm glad to see you.
It's a pleasure to see you, too, sir. I always feel at home here.
That's how I want you to feel, Henry. This is in no way a formal meeting. You know, it's a strange paradox, but it's harder for a president to have real friends than it is for any other man. And yet no man needs friends more. But in you and Miss Sarah here, I feel I have real friends.
I've always hoped you felt that way, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, Henry, you and I were boys in Virginia together. We've been in politics for a long time, sometimes on opposite sides of the fence. And during the years you've been Speaker of the House, we've had our differences. But I always knew I could count on you. And even though she pretends she doesn't, Miss Sarah knows I'd be lost without her.
Why, Mr. President?
Miss Sarah's a diplomatic woman.
Diplomatic? Thank goodness we don't have any lady ambassadors. I'd lose the best secretary man ever had.
Well, thank you.
But as I was saying, I want to discuss something with you, Henry. I'm appointing Ninian Edwards minister to Mexico.
Well, he should be quite capable.
Well, my Secretary of the Treasury is dead set against Edwards' appointment. I'd like to change Crawford's attitude towards Edwards a bit before he leaves Washington for Mexico. Maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I'd like to think of the people under me as a unit working together.
Do Mr. Edwards and Mr. Crawford know each other, sir?
Oh, I'm sure they must be acquainted. But that's probably as far as it goes. Now, I'd like to make an attempt to bring them together.
How would you like to go about it, sir?
Well, Henry, that's where you come in. You've invited Miss Sarah and me to a small dinner party next Monday night, I believe. I wonder if you'd mind adding Crawford and Edwards to your guest list.
No, not at all, Mr. President. Be very happy to.
Well, thank you very much, Henry. I appreciate it. Perhaps the evening would also serve to convince Crawford that I'm not opposed to his election in the fall. Often I feel as completely relaxed as I do this evening. I think it's your home that does it. Don't you find there's a comfortable atmosphere about it? Crawford, Edwards?
Well, sir, no doubt. I beg your pardon, Mr. Edwards.
No, no. Go right ahead, Mr. Crawford.
I was only going to say, sir, that I've always enjoyed Mr. Clinton's hospitality.
Of course, I'm not the seasoned Washingtonian Mr. Crawford is, but in the few years I've been here, I've always been most grateful for invitations from Mr. Clinton.
Well, you're all very kind. Glad we're able to have this little dinner before you left, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you.
Yes, so am I, Henry. We need evenings like this more often. We get so bogged down with governmental business, we're sometimes apt to forget the people we're associated with are still very human. At times, I'm afraid Miss Sarah thinks I mistake her for a perpetual motion machine.
Oh, not at all, Mr. President.
You see how loyal she is, even though I am a slave driver? Oh, heavens, don't tell me that's 10:30 striking.
It certainly is, sir. The evening's gone very quickly.
Again, proof of its pleasantness.
Well, I'd better get my raft.
All right, Miss Aaron, while you're doing that, I want to see that new fishing rod Henry's been bragging about. If you gentlemen will excuse me.
Certainly, sir. Right this way, Mr. President. And I promise you, you'll want one like it.
Yes, except that I never have the time to go fishing, Henry.
Well, Mr. Crawford, I think we managed ourselves quite well this evening, don't you?
Just what do you mean, Mr. Edwards?
Come now, Crawford. The President isn't within earshot. We needn't pretend to have friendly feelings toward one another.
I should never bother to do so to you, Mr. Edwards.
Nor I to you, sir. Tell me, have you been able to discover the author of the A.B. letters as yet?
Mr. Edwards, I have no intention of letting you raise my anger. I refuse to discuss the matter.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought perhaps you'd learn to laugh them off by now. But just forget I mentioned them.
Yes, I will.
Let's talk about something else. Have you ever been to Mexico, Mr. Crawford?
I have not.
I was wondering if you thought I'd like it there. I'm quite satisfied with my appointment.
If I were you, Mr. Edwards, I wouldn't become too fond of Mexico.
Oh? Why do you say that?
Because if I win the election this fall, one of my first executive acts will be to replace you as minister.
Yes, Miss Sarah.
Just wanted to tell you, Mr. President, all arrangements have been made for your transportation. Within a few days, you'll be spending that vacation with your family.
Miss Sarah, you get things done with the speed of 10 secretaries.
Well, I wanted to have everything ready before you changed your mind, sir. You don't know how happy I am. You're finally getting away for a while.
Yes, I'll admit I'm looking forward to it. For once, I don't think I have any real worries to shadow me.
You'll come back feeling like a new person, sir.
I hope.
Excuse me, I'll see who that is. Mr. Clinton.
Good morning, Miss Sarah.
Oh, hello, Henry. Come in.
Good morning, Mr. President. I'm sorry to interrupt you, sir.
What's the matter, Henry? What is it? What's happened?
Mr. President, I just received a letter from Ninian Edwards written en route to Mexico. It was sent to me in my official capacity as Speaker of the House.
Well, what does it say?
I have it here, sir, and I think you should read it.
All right. Well, let me see it. I hereby charge William Harris Crawford with illegal use of public funds and malfeasance in his office as Secretary of the Treasury. I accuse him of sole responsibility for the failure of the bank in Edwardsville, Illinois. I hereby demand his impeachment by the House of Representatives. And I consider this an opportune time to declare that I am the author of the letters which have been appearing in Washington newspapers for a year under the initials of A.B. Good heavens.
Yes, I was as shocked as you, sir.
Edwards has been writing these letters. Of all the people I suspected, I never once thought of him.
Well, what can be done, sir?
Well, there's only one thing to do. I'll send the sergeant-at-arms after Edwards at once to bring him back to Washington. Oh, well, that, Miss Sarah, is the end of my vacation.
In just a moment, we'll come back to Edward Arnold and Mr. President.
Have you ever thought of how the words freedom from fear might apply to you? One fear that might bear on any of us is the fear for security in our jobs, churches, and homes. In a society where there are prejudices, no one can feel secure. In such a society, no one can be completely without fear. Therefore, if you hold prejudices against any person because of his race, religion, or national origin, you're placing yourself in a position where others might be turned against you. So we must all fight prejudice. Judge people by the character of their lives alone. Work in your community, in your church, business, trade unions, your schools, to promote our American principles of racial and religious freedom. Remember, if you work to eliminate prejudice, you're working to eliminate one cause of fear for your own security. Now, back to Edward Arnold and Mr. President.
Have you guessed by now who the president was in this story? Remember that political enmities have existed since the beginning of government, and there's seldom been a president who hasn't had to cope with the problem, though not all of them became so serious. Later on, I'll tell you which one this was. The news of Ninian Edwards' letter concerning William Crawford swept Washington within a day. A political war was on, with two definite camps, one comprising the friends of Edwards and the other the friends of Crawford. When Ninian Edwards arrived back in Washington, I had him come directly to my office. Well, Edwards, I didn't expect to be seeing you so soon again.
Frankly, sir, I didn't expect that you would recall me to Washington.
And you gave me no choice. That letter of yours had serious charges in it against Governor Crawford.
I grant you that, Mr. President, but I thought you might wait until the fall to go into the matter. After all, Congress is adjourning within a week.
You know, Edwards, a lot of Crawford's friends are saying you timed that letter with just that in mind, hoping that the affair would ride until the next session of Congress so that Crawford's chances in the fall election would be ruined.
Yes, Mr. President, that was my idea.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't based on the whim of a moment. I have valid grounds for maintaining that Crawford is not fit for his office of Secretary of the Treasury, and I'd do most anything I could to prevent his election to the presidency.
At least you're honest about it, but I don't think you realize what a stir this affair was going to cause.
Well, I'll admit I didn't expect it to turn Washington upside down as it has, Mr. President. I'm sorry to have been the cause of so much worry to you.
It doesn't matter about me, Edwards, but you should have thought of yourself.
What do you mean, sir?
Well, your one plan since the first of the A.B. letters has been to hurt Crawford. But you may find you've ruined your own political career.
I'm not concerned about that, sir. As I said, I have facts to back up my accusations of Crawford. He has deliberately misused public funds, and I'm willing to go on record on that.
Right, which you already have gone on record. However, it's still not too late to repair the damages. If you would make a statement retracting your letter...
Never, sir. Mr. President, I think you have confidence in me, or you wouldn't have appointed me minister to Mexico.
Of course I do. You have a fine record up to now. And I like you personally, but hang it all, man. I can no longer save you if your charges are false.
They aren't false, Mr. President. I'm willing to stake my reputation on that.
Huh? I can take that as your final answer, then? You won't make a retraction?
No, sir.
Mm-hmm. Very well, Edwards. I don't think we need to discuss the matter any further.
I'm trying to see you for a week, Mr. President.
Yes, Crawford, I know. I think I've had half of Washington in my office within the last few days.
I thought you might spare me a little time before this.
Now, look, Crawford, you and I have had our personal differences, but you've got to realize that I'm as upset about this matter as you are. There was no point in my seeing you until I talked with Ninian Edwards.
You've seen him?
I didn't have to hear less than an hour ago.
Has he persuaded you that his charges against me are justified?
Of course not. You've been a member of my cabinet for 8 years. I have the highest esteem for your ability and integrity as Secretary of the Treasury.
But you know what the real issue at stake is here, sir. Edwards is trying to keep me from the presidency in the fall.
He admitted that to me, Crawford. I thought he might be willing to retract his indictment when he saw I wasn't going to let the affair ride, but he refuses.
I don't know what you expect me to do, sir.
Do? Well, nothing except be as honest with me as possible. I said the same thing to Edwards. I respect both of you. But it's only common horse sense that one of you must be wrong in this thing. And if I call an investigation, it will undoubtedly mean political ruin for one of you. Now, if you know of any basis for Edwards' accusations...
Mr. President, those charges are false from beginning to end. I would welcome an investigation. If you don't care to accept my word, why...
Why, Mr. Crawford, since your word and Edwards are diametrically opposed, I can't accept both. There's only one thing left to do. Air the whole thing in a public investigation.
Silence! Silence, please. Continue, Mr. Crawford.
As Secretary of the Treasury, I feel I have done all in my power to execute my office to the best of my ability. There are many states in our country which have a deranged currency. Now, after long thought and wise counsel, I decided to select certain banks of deposit and take the notes of certain other banks in payment for public land. Had I not done so, many inhabitants would have been turned out of doors and lost their lands. Had this happened, I would deserve the accusations which are now being hurled at me so falsely.
Mr. Edwards.
I should like to cite, Mr. Speaker, for the committee's consideration, the matter of the Bank of Edwardsville, Illinois, which defaulted in a considerable sum to the government. Families lost their life savings. But that bank need never have defaulted, except for the gross neglect of the Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Crawford.
Mr. Speaker, I object.
Yes, Mr. Crawford.
How could the failure of the Edwardsville Bank be due to my gross neglect, as Mr. Edwards puts it, when I was totally unaware of its precarious position until it was too late to save it? Shouldn't the governor of the state, who was Mr. Edwards, have informed me of the situation?
I did inform you, Mr. Crawford. Long before the bank failure, I sent you a letter informing you of the condition of the bank.
That is not true, Mr. Speaker. I was never sent such a letter by Mr. Edwards.
Mr. Speaker, I should like to present as evidence a copy from my files of that very letter.
Henry, what do you make of it?
I'm at a loss as to what we should do now, Mr. President. The investigation has simply been going in circles for days, ending up right back where it started.
The whole thing hinges on that letter.
Yes, exactly. Edwards insists that he sent it, his secretary substantiate him, yet Crawford swears he never got such a letter, and so does his secretary.
If either of the men had had a black mark on their record before, it would be easier to doubt one of them. But as strange as it seems, I believe both the men are telling the truth.
Well, it's quite possible, sir. Letters have been lost before they reached their destination.
Well, I'm sure that's what must have happened. But it would be a little difficult to convince the court of that.
If you had the proof, you could convince them, sir.
How does one prove something's been lost?
By finding it again, sir.
Well, Miss Sarah, you are ingenious. I haven't been able to see the trees for the forest or the forest for the trees.
It would mean a great deal of trouble, Mr. President. The search might prove fruitless.
But at least there's a chance, Henry. Miss Sarah, I want every post office at Edwardsville and Washington to search through their dead letter of departments immediately.
President.
Miss Sarah, do I dare to hope? From the look in your face...
Yes, Mr. President, yes.
Oh, no.
It's been located. A special messenger just brought it from a Washington post office.
Oh, thank heaven, Miss Sarah. Now, I want to send a letter to Henry Clinton immediately.
Yes, sir.
Just say, my dear Mr. Speaker, I'm happy, to report that the letter which Ninian Edwards declared to have sent to William Crawford was mailed, but that the letter never reached Mr. Crawford, as it was lost en route. The letter has been retrieved, however, and I now have it in my possession.
Mr. President?
Yes, Miss Sarah?
Mr. Edwards and Mr. Crawford would like to see you, sir.
Oh, no. Show them in.
Yes, sir. This way, gentlemen.
Thank you, thank you.
Well, gentlemen, I'm certainly glad to see you.
I should imagine, sir, that you'd welcome not ever having me in your sight again after the trouble I've caused you.
Oh, nonsense. Troubles are easily forgotten. At least I hope that's the way it'll be with you two.
Well, in spite of our differences, Mr. President, Edwards and I agree on one thing, that we owe you a sincere debt of gratitude for the honesty and fairness with which you treated both of us.
I said from the beginning that I believed both of your stories. Happily enough, I was proved right.
But there aren't many men who would have gone to the lengths you did, sir.
Oh, now, wait. I wasn't doing it just for you alone.
Well, I understand that, sir. I know you did it out of duty to your office and to the things that this country stands for. And, Mr. President, I would like to apologize for the way I've acted toward you on several occasions in the past.
Oh, forget it, Crawford. Forget it.
I'm afraid I can't, sir. I'll admit I was envious because you had twice beaten me in the presidential elections. But I want to tell you now, sir, that if I had to take a beating, I can't think of a better man to have given it to me.
Well, you can't tell, Crawford, with this mess all cleared up, you may come out the winner next time. Well, you've probably figured out by now who I was when all that happened. It really did happen, you know, and I'll tell you the answer in just a moment.
You'll be first with the facts when you hear Drew Pearson on the air every Sunday evening over most of these same ABC stations. When Drew Pearson goes on the air from the Capitol, you know you are hearing the inside version of the news, the factual highlights that lie behind the headlines. For Drew Pearson gets behind the headlines, talks with statesmen and other high-ranking officials in order to bring you informed reports on current national and international affairs. So for predictions and inside stories of the news, listen in when Drew Pearson is heard this evening and every Sunday evening over most ABC stations. Night and day, we keep you up on the latest news. So keep your dial tuned the ABC way. Now here again is Edward Arnold.
The time of our story was 1824, and Mr. President then was a man noted for his tact and diplomacy, a true Virginian and a gentleman, James Monroe. In a letter to Thomas Jefferson, President Monroe described the Edwards-Crawford affair as the most painful of his life. But with the help of his good friend Henry Clay, whom we called Henry Clinton, he conducted it in a fair and just way that brought him praise from the entire nation. Come and see me again next week, won't you? I'll have another story for you about Mr. President that I'm sure you'll enjoy. Goodbye.
Arnold appeared by arrangement with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, producers of the Technicolor musical A Date with Judy, starring Wallace Beery, Jane Powell, and Elizabeth Taylor. Mr. President was created by Robert G. Jennings. It is produced and directed by Dwight Houser. Miss Sarah was played by Betty Lou Gerson. This transcribed story by Agnes Eckhart was suggested by incidents in the administration of President James Monroe. Music was composed and conducted by Basil Adlam.
Be sure to listen again next week when the American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations bring you Edward Arnold with another interesting and factual story of Mr. President. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
Mr. President, on Tuned to Yesterday from July 31st, 1947 on ABC. We now close this hour of true history with an excerpt of Behind the Mic, which profiles a man who is an innovator in American radio, though from across the pond. It's the story of Colonel Thomas T. Davis, known for his work on one of radio's earliest shows, The Collier Hour, via 1927. Graham McNamee, a radio legend in his own right, is the host in this excerpt from the NBC Blue Network, heard on October 27th, 1940.
We in radio believe that radio has a tradition of good programs that lingers fondly in our memory. But it has something more than that. It has splendid tradition of radio pioneers, people who have acted in programs, who have created them, and who have helped to make radio what it is today. And here is news commentator John B. Kennedy to pay tribute to one of the finest of these pioneers, Colonel Charles T. Davis. He has a most unusual and dramatic story to tell. John B. Kennedy.
None of us who associated with Colonel Charles T. Davis in radio can ever forget him. I worked with him on the old Collier's Hour, on which he collaborated with my old friend Malcolm Laprade. Colonel Davis Graham was a most unusual man. He was a retired English army officer who had served in India and Mesopotamia. He was bronzed, of medium height, and quite handsome. I've always thought it amazing that an Englishman with his background should, in the early 20s, when radio was quite new, see the possibilities that American radio had, and should become a radio writer, director, and actor.
Two of the most famous characters he acted were Old Man Donaldson and Don Amazo. Isn't that so, John?
That's right, Graham. They were two of the most famous characters in early radio, and he, with Malcolm Laprade, was the first writer to do dramatizations of motion pictures for radio. But the Collier's Hour, the first magazine of the air, which started in 1927, was really his baby. He helped write the script, he cast it, and he acted roles in it. And that program itself was a real pioneer. For instance, one day before rehearsal, we were talking in the studio. What do you think of that idea, John?
I think it's all right, John. I don't see why we shouldn't have people in the studio watching our broadcast. What do you say, Fred?
Oh, but, Colonel, it's never been done.
Well, just because no other programs have had an audience in the studio is no reason why we shouldn't.
Yes, but it's disillusioning for people to see us reading scripts.
Oh, we can't keep this thing a mystery forever. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if someday almost all programs had people in the studio watching them.
Well, Colonel, it's certainly an innovation.
It wouldn't be our first. After all, here we are on a Sunday night program, and people said we would never dare play popular music on Sunday night. But we did. And now a lot of other programs are doing the same thing. Now, if you people have your scripts, we'd better start rehearsing.
Sometime in 1929, the colonel became very ill. But he continued directing the program, helping to write it and to act in it. He had to undergo a very serious operation, which he postponed until the show was off the air for the summer of 1929. Shortly before we returned to the air, he had his second serious operation. But he kept in touch with the program, even though he was far too ill to work on it or to attend to the broadcasts. I never can and I never shall forget the Collier's Hour broadcast of January the 12th, 1930. It comes to me again quite vividly. We were broadcasting from the lodge in what was called the Cathedral Studio of the old NBC building on Fifth Avenue. The cast was on the stage, and in front sat an eager audience. Our cast was in the midst of a dramatization of a current Collier story.
Don't get the idea I'm afraid of her, but she did go down to see Joe Smythe this afternoon.
Aye, and you ain't sure as to what she might do, are you?
No, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if she's up to something. I feel she knows more about the murder than she lets on.
Aye.
Colonel, this is a surprise.
I jolly well had to come over just to see how things were coming.
Well, old man, how do you feel?
Splendid, old man. Splendid.
But, Colonel...
Shh. John, there's a broadcast going on.
Well, I'm certainly glad to see you here. Graham, the colonel sat in the studio during the rest of the broadcast. He was terribly ill. But he was just as interested in everything that went on as when he was helping direct the show and write the script. His courage never deserted him for one moment. But the most amazing thing that struck me was his attire. He was immaculately dressed in white tie and tails, as though his appearance at this broadcast marked some special occasion, and probably it did. It must have been an agonizing effort for him to appear at all. But something I'll never forget occurred when I made my sign-off announcement. I was announcing the features of next week's show. Next week, ladies and gentlemen, we will bring you an interesting dramatization of the new Guy Gilpatrick story. And John Erskine, the famous author, will appear in person to tell you about it. Graham, that was what the listeners heard. But if they only could have been in the studio, what they would have seen was this. As I finished my final announcement, Colonel Davis left his chair, and he walked up to the microphone. He opened his mouth as if to talk into the mic, and I could see him desperately struggling to speak, but he couldn't utter a sound. He tried again. Then he shrugged his shoulders and slowly walked back to his chair. I always felt that he wanted to say a last goodbye to the radio audience in America to whom he had given so much. Several weeks later, I made this announcement at the close of the Collier's Hour. Since the inception of Collier's Hour 3 years ago, ladies and gentlemen, you have heard either the voice or the work of Colonel Thomas Davis. We regret to say that you will hear them no more. For on Wednesday morning, Tom Davis died. In his passing, radio lost a pioneer artist, Collier's Hour a valued associate, and I a very dear friend. Colonel Davis was a soldier and a gentleman. Epitaph enough for any man.
An excerpt of Behind the Mic from October 27th, 1940 on the NBC Blue Network. Wrapping up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday, be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVanier. Thanks for tuning in.